To another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm very excited to be here with you today. The fall weather is just beautiful. The trees are turning colors. Everything is just so vibrant outside, and it's just beautiful. And my guest today is going to be Missy Doe Axelrod. She is a farm-to-school educator at the Vermont Farm and Forest School. And that's up in Vermont at Drift Farmstead, and I'm really excited to have her on. And she'll be coming on in just a little bit. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and also some events you might want to participate in. So first, you know, when it comes to taking action, I have to say I was so happy to read an article about Jane Fonda taking action. She actually moved to Washington, D.C. so that she can protest every Friday in front of the Capitol to raise awareness about climate change. And at 81, she is, you know, getting herself arrested, spending a night in jail, sleeping on a, you know, on her, using her coat as a blanket, sleeping on the mattress. I mean, it's just amazing, and she's really, you know, taking action. And I just remember when I was down in Washington and protested the Keystone XL pipeline, how proud I was to have my, to be handcuffed and go in a paddy wagon and get arrested. And it was just a highlight of my life. And I just think we all need to really consider taking this kind of drastic action to raise awareness and let the world know, and let all the people in our country know, that this is a travesty to not deal with climate change. And I know we have an administration that just doesn't want to deal with it, but it is so important. So I was really happy to hear Jane Fonda doing what she's doing. Very often she has, you know, some of her other celebrity friends in tow with her. And she invites all of us to join. So anytime on a Friday, if you can find yourself in Washington, D.C., you can join the movement. And I'm sure many of you heard that the Keystone Pipeline, not the section, not the XL section, the extra part that we were protesting against, but the basic Keystone Pipeline, leaked 380,000 gallons of oil in North Dakota. And that was the second spill in a week. There was another one in Montana, you know, near the border of Montana, and that leaked another 84,000 gallons of crude oil. So we just have to stop this. I mean, I don't know what it's going to take, but we just have to keep the pressure up, keep pushing, sign those petitions, show up at rallies, and we all need to do what we need to do to raise awareness that we have to transition into renewable energy. We need to get off of fossil fuels. You know, the connection between big business and their influence in our government has just to kind of stop also. And so, you know, we just have to all pay attention. So I wrote about some petitions that you could sign this week. One was through the Environmental Defense Fund, asking us to ask Congress to co-sponsor the Clean Economy Act. You know, we know what we need to do. It's just a matter of getting our senators and legislators on board to co-sponsor these acts and override the president. So we've got to keep pushing. So much to do. But some really great events are coming up in and around New York that you may want to participate in, and I want to share those with you. There is a great festival going on at the Albertine Bookshop November 8th through the 10th, and this is a free event, and it will be curated by the environmentalist and author Bill McKibben, who actually is who I protested the Keystone Pipeline with down in Washington, D.C. But he was the founder of 350.org. He's raised so many people's awareness about the environmental crisis that we are in. And he is going to be curating and interviewing all the different people and panelists at this book festival. So it's at Albertine Books. It's on Fifth Avenue in New York City. It's a free event starting Friday evening, November 8th. And it continues through the weekend. So it's free. You just need to RSVP. Then on November 9th through the 10th, there's a screening at the International Film Center in the city, in Chelsea, The Story of Plastic. And this is a documentary film. There will be speakers following the film. And I heard it's great. So I haven't seen it yet, but I certainly hope to. November 9th at the 92nd Street Y, there's a food summit. That should be great. Also, that's going on all day. November 9th is the 14th annual Thanks Living at the Woodstock Farm Sanctuary. And that is a farm sanctuary that saves animals from being slaughtered. And I think there's still a few tickets left for that if you are interested. What else is going on? The 9th Annual Soil and Nutrition Conference is going on at Southbridge Hotel and Conference Center in Southbridge, Massachusetts, November 14th through 17th. And then, of course, my Feeding the Homeless is coming up, the Thanksgiving feast that I hope many of you will participate in. That is taking place on November 24th. It's always the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And if you haven't seen the documentary that was made about the Thanksgiving feast, you might want to check that out. You can find it on YouTube or on my website. It's on the media page on my website, or you can just go to YouTube and type in Thanksgiving Back, and you'll see this great documentary video. It's short, but it's about the Thanksgiving feast that we put together. This will be our 25th year of doing it, and it's really a community event. We have over 100 people that show up through the IE Green Homestead participating, cooking. You can bring your kids. There's a crayon station. You know, people take breaks, play frisbee out on the yard, but then they come back and we're cooking, chopping, washing, doing everything you need to do to create a Thanksgiving feast for. We make enough food for 1,000 people. So it's really quite an event. So if you can join us, there's a sign-up doodle document that you can also find on my website. And now I'd like to share with you my weekly recipe. I've been promising you my seitan marsala, which is a traditional dish that I make every year for Thanksgiving, along with my stuffed pumpkin, which I'll share with you in the upcoming weeks. But the seitan marsala is a wonderful dish because it gets sliced and you need to cut it with a fork and knife. It has mushroom gravy to go with it, and that gravy is great to put on your vegetarian stuffing and mashed potatoes and all the other traditional foods that you have at a Thanksgiving feast if you're not eating your turkey. So I start with 2 packages of seitan, White Wave or Raise or brands that you can find that are in the store, or I make my own homemade seitan. I shared that recipe with you a few weeks ago. So you can do that. I use an egg to bread the seitan. However, if you are vegan and you do not want to use egg, you can always make an egg substitute with 2 tablespoons of ground flaxseed, mixing it with 1 tablespoon of water and 1 table apple cider vinegar. And that works really well. So you can do that as your egg substitute. Then I have a cup of breadcrumbs that I season with oregano, garlic powder, basil, salt, and pepper. You can use whole wheat breadcrumbs or regular breadcrumbs. Just make sure that they're a good quality. Very often I'm saving my leftover stale bread and making my own breadcrumbs, and I have jars of those, so that's what I use. You need olive oil, 1 pound of mushrooms, and you can use portobello mushrooms or baby bellas or just plain white mushrooms, whatever you like. 1 stick of butter. You can substitute 1/2 cup of olive oil again. That's for making the roux for the mushroom gravy. Marsala wine you will need. Tamari, which is fermented soy sauce that's gluten-free, although in this recipe, gluten-free does not matter since seitan is gluten. 4 cloves of garlic, And then you need some flour, salt and pepper, thyme, and poultry seasoning. And so I start by slicing the seitan into like 1/4 inch thick slices. So you want them to be, you know, hefty slices of seitan. And you can lay them out on a towel and dry them with another towel on top just to dry them a bit. Then you're going to bread the seitan the way you would bread anything, by dipping it in the egg or the egg substitute, and then the bread crumbs that you've seasoned. And do that until all the pieces are done. And then cover the bottom of your heavy skillet, I use a cast iron skillet, with some olive oil. When the oil's hot, you're going to fry up all the pieces of seitan until they're golden brown on one side, then turn them over and repeat until they're golden brown on the other side. Then you can remove the pieces of seitan from the pan, wipe it out. You probably have to do a couple rounds of that to do all the seitan that you're going to make, depending on how much you're making. And you can lay the seitan pieces out on some paper towel to absorb any of the oil. And then when you're finished with sautéing all the seitan, wipe out the pan, and let's use the pan again for making the gravy. And you're going to first sauté the mushrooms in some garlic with 2 tablespoons of butter or olive oil. I usually use olive oil for sautéing the mushrooms, and then you can put just a little butter in at the end if you want to give it a little umami. And then add 1 or 2 tablespoons of marsala to the mushrooms and let them sauté them until the liquid is absorbed. So you really want to get them really a little bit crispy, you know, like really cook those mushrooms well so that they're they have a good texture to them. And then you're going to remove them from the pan and set the mushrooms aside, and again wipe out the pan to reuse to make the gravy. And you're going to melt either the remaining 6 tablespoons of butter or the remaining olive oil in the saucepan. You're going to add 6 tablespoons of flour to the melted butter or oil. And with a whisk, you're going to mix that all up so that it's really smooth. And then you're going to cook that just a little bit. That's called the roux, the mixture of the flour with the oil or butter, until it turns a light brown color. Then you're going to add 1/4 cup of Marsala wine to that. Keep whisking. Then add 2 cups of either stock or water, and keep whisking it. You want to prevent any lumps. You just add that slowly, keep whisking it. Then you're going to add 1 tablespoon of tamari to that, some salt and pepper to taste, 1/4 teaspoon of poultry spice, which is a mixture of a lot of Provence-type herbs, you know, thyme, rosemary, sage, and you're going to mix those into the seasoning. If you have fresh herbs and you want to add those separately, you can. You can add a little extra thyme if you'd like. And then taste it. You know, I really taste my sauces because it's always a little different, depending on whether you're using stock, depending on the wine you're using, etc. So just taste it. You can add a little more stock if it's too thick. You can add a little more roux if you want to. And just make it delicious. And that is it. Then you're going to add the mushrooms back into that gravy. And you're going to lay the seitan out onto a platter and cover it with this Marsala gravy. And then garnish it with some chopped parsley. And that is it. It is really delicious. And I hope you make it. I love feedback. So, you know, you can hashtag I Eat Green Recipes and make a comment that way. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest this week, Missy Doe Axelrod. She's the farm-to-school educator up at the Vermont Farm and Forest School at Drift Farmstead. And she has over 20 years' experience in sustainable agriculture, and she's been educating wondrous minds from 3 years old to adults for many, many years. And Missy values community growth both in the natural world and in the human world. And when she's not on the farm growing food or hosting educational programs, Missy's working in a dozen schools in central Vermont teaching farm, food, and nutrition. And she's also the farm-to-community mentor with NOFA Vermont. And she had her start in school when she got her BA in Community Food Systems. And I'm so happy to have Missy on. Missy, are you with me?
Oh, Bhavani, I am. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me. I don't know if you know, but I started actually this year in a local public school as their farm-to-school coordinator. So I'm so interested in learning more about what you do and maybe, you know, learning from you and incorporating some of your expertise into what I'm doing in my public school.
Wonderful.
So maybe you could start by sharing with us how you got started in farming, just a little bit about your history, and then how you got into educational farming.
Sure. It's been a journey. I took a gap year in between high school and college, and I lived and volunteered in an intentional community in Kimberton, Pennsylvania called Camp Hill. There's a series of them around the world. They're Rudolf Steiner-based, and the community that I volunteered in was a farm-based community. I lived in the family house on the organic dairy farm. They also had a large CSA, a weavery, a spinnery, a bakery, and the concept of that was for everybody to really work together with some special needs adults, and they actually are one of the special needs adults are the ones that taught me all about dairy farming, and I fell in love with it and knew that that is what I wanted to do. And so after that year of basically just being introduced to cooking for large numbers of people for family meals, organic dairy farming, rotational grazing, I then went on to Green Mountain College in southern Vermont, and I had to, at that time, develop my own major in community systems, sustainable agriculture, because there was not a major at that time. They had a very small raised bed area, and during my 4 years there, I worked with my advisor, Philip Ackerman Leist, and helped to develop a sustainable business plan for a college farm, and so I really got a lot of my learning curve by doing at the college, and in between some summers, I interned at farms in Pennsylvania and Illinois, and learned everywhere from super small micro farm management to large scale. And from there, I went on to starting my own small farm in southern Vermont while working in restaurants at night, because farmers always need another income. And so for many, many years, I always had restaurant hotel management in the evenings and farming during the day, and did that for, I don't know, maybe 10 years after college. And then I had my first child 7 years ago and realized that it would not be very sustainable to continue with the late nights, working in restaurants, weekends, holidays, and farming during the day. So I gave up the restaurant work and decided to focus in the world of just farming. And I was kind of taking it slow, trying to figure out really what my focus was going to be. And the interesting part was there was a guidance counselor at my college who was moving on to another college, cleaning out her office, and she sent me my journal that we had to keep our freshman year, that we would write back and forth to each other of our hopes and goals and dreams and academics and personal life. And I had two pages filled out, and in one of that it said I wanted to focus on therapeutical farming. And at that time, it really wasn't a thing, and beyond a few different communities that we're doing. And so I was still trying to figure out, how do I really want to focus on farming? I know I don't want to be a large-scale farm. I need to work with people. I knew that was goal number one. So I started volunteering at our little village school. I helped build some raised beds after they washed away after a really big flooding here about 7 years ago. And the volunteer work with building those beds turned into me writing a grant for the school to get some more farm-to-school funding. And then as the years moved on, that moved into more and more time with me spending at schools. And it went from one school of 40 kids to about 12 schools of several thousand. And that was just years of kind of learning what schools wanted, needed, how could we integrate the farm to school into the classroom and at local farms. And it just kind of organically grew in that way from focusing on just farming to farm-based education.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe you could share with us a little bit what your farm-to-school programming looks like.
Sure. So So first off, I ended up developing our farm and really turning it into an educational farm. So we are a small family farm nestled in the hills of Roxbury, Vermont. We grow only about an acre of organic vegetables for winter farm shares, and then we have cows, pigs, chickens, and sheep. And we're doing a lot of educational programming here, both for farm-to-schools that are participating in farm-to-school programming, as well as other groups, and doing summer camps here and hosting groups from out of state. The farm-to-school programming is a part of the Vermont Feed, which is Vermont Farm Education Every Day, Vermont Farm and Food Education Every Day, and it is a nonprofit that is a collaboration between Shelburne Farms and the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And they're really the lead in the country in terms of really how the structure of farm to school developed through the USDA. So Vermont has its own farm to school grant program that offers funding to schools that apply through a grant system and then receive the funding to focus on the three C's. So our farm-to-school program really follows that model of Vermont Feed. So the three C's are community, curriculum, and cafeteria. And so when I'm working with schools, preschool through high school, we're really looking at how can we bring the farmer and the food to the classroom, and then the second piece, bringing the classroom to the farm, and really looking at educating the students in food equity, healthy diets, nutrition education, investing in local agriculture, and just learning about their food systems. And then the second piece is the cafeteria and working on procuring ultra-local foods as well as regional foods into the food meal program at the schools. And then the community piece is working with the local farmers, community members, bringing everybody together to share meals at harvest dinners, bringing in experts from the field to help teach in the classroom, and really focusing on that community sufficiency piece for farmers and students who will be our future food purchasers.
Mm-hmm. So what percentage of your work is taking place at your farm, at the Vermont Farm and Forest School, and how much are you doing in the actual schools?
It's changing every year. This year, during the school calendar year, probably about 60% is in the classroom and 40% is either at my farm or other farms. During the summer, 100% is on the farm with classes, summer school programs coming here, or our summer camps and farming.
Mm-hmm. So when you're in the school, you know, I'm trying to figure out how you balance the three C's, the cafeteria,
yeah,
the community, and the curriculum. You know, I guess you have a lot of local farmers, but, you know, comes wintertime, where are you getting the vegetables from locally?
Good question. So we have been working, the state of Vermont through Vermont Feed has been really honing in on local procurement and following USDA regulations for forward contracts and doing three bids and a buy. So we're focusing on what Vermont is good at. What do we grow really well that we can have access to during the whole school year? So we're obviously not going to be getting tomatoes and peppers. We're really mostly focusing on beef, maple syrup, and root crops. So what we do is we meet with our food service directors and farmers in January, typically, when everything's covered in snow, farmers have a little bit more time to breathe, they're starting to put in their seed orders for the next year, and we say, hey, what do you grow a lot of? What's at a price point that the school can afford? Because price is pretty much number one. And we will then say, okay, we can use 200 pounds of carrots delivered every other week. We can use 200 pounds of rutabagas, winter squash, beets, kale, potatoes, and we create a contract with that farmer saying we are committed to buying X amount of pounds delivery once a week or every other week. And so the farmers here in Vermont are have created root cellars, and they're able to store their crops and keep them all winter long. And that's been a really viable option for our schools to focus on those crops that farmers do have available. And so we really do a lot of training sessions with our food service directors as well as the farmers to be able to pair them up and find the right matches.
And then what about for processing the fresh vegetables? I mean, you know, one of the things that I've come across is, you know, like, yes, I could get potatoes in the middle of the winter, but who's going to wash them and chop them and and process them when these ladies in the cafeteria are used to opening a bag of frozen French fries, putting them in a sheet pan, and sticking them in the oven?
Yeah, so we offer technical assistance through grant programs of various sorts in Vermont. We have, we'll go as close as to bringing somebody from Vermont Feed or myself into the kitchen and training how to wash, cut, prep raw carrots or squash. We also have funding available for schools to purchase equipment. For robo-coups or dicers, things that can help them process faster. Some schools bring in volunteer teams after school hours to maybe in August process tons of sweet corn and freeze it so that they can have corn chowder in the middle of the winter. It's really different for each school of what they have available and what, you know, access to in terms of kitchen equipment. And so we really try to support them so that they can have the means to utilize the fresh produce in the winter time.
Yeah, that's really a big challenge.
Yeah, and I think we're really lucky here in Vermont that we've been doing farm to school at a pretty deep level for so long, and we've had all sorts of technical assistance through Vermont Feed, Shelburne Farms. The School Nutrition Association does trainings at their two-day conference, and we've really helped support the staff for processing. That said, it's still a challenge, especially the one-person kitchens where they're feeding 150 people and there's one in the kitchen and they're really trying to execute large quantities of food fast. And so we'll try to work with, if they're connected with a kitchen that is larger and has more capacity to maybe dice carrots ahead of time, we'll ask, you know, kind of create that network for them to do it at the bigger kitchen and then send the pre-diced carrots, for example.
And what about, like, for washing large quantities of potatoes? Is there
the farmers,
a commercial washing
bring everything
machine?
Washed. So that is a requirement is that everything is washed. And the farmers that the schools work with follow food safety plans. And so we know that the water is been tested, it's clean. And if they need to rewash, then the kitchens, most of the kitchens that I'm working with have large sinks and are able to handle washing.
Okay, so the potatoes are already coming scrubbed.
Yeah, absolutely. All the food is, because we know that that's a time commitment, you know, time commitment to have washing in the kitchen.
Wow. So, and do the farms have commercial cleaning?
Most of the farms that are selling to schools are larger because they're meeting that wholesale price point. So we're, you know, I personally don't sell to schools because I'm too small. I do all retail. So we're really trying to match the schools with the farmers that have HACCP plans, the food safety plans. Therefore, they have large root cellar, you know, walk-in refrigerators. They have root washing machines. They're kind of the bigger equipment farms. And when we say big farms here in Vermont, we're talking anywhere from 4 acres to maybe 20 acres.
Okay. Yeah, because, you know, I guess I'm working with Long Island farmers, and they're not that big, and I don't think they have those the capacity for washing the vegetables.
Yeah.
So we're getting them very dirty. And so,
yeah,
I mean,
that,
the time, I just know when I cook for the Thanksgiving feast, I think you heard me talking about that at the beginning, you know, we get 300 pounds of potatoes here, and I have it. I have so many volunteers scrubbing them because I don't peel them. So scrubbing them, and that takes days.
Yeah,
literally.
I bet.
You know, I mean, you really have to scrub them well with, you know.
Yeah. So I wonder
brush.
If some sort of community food hub where farmers bring their crops to a location to do root washing, or if there's a community root washing that travels from farm to farm. I don't know what the proximity of locations are, but that's that community piece where people can come together and share equipment, possibly.
I'm going to look into that. So since you've been doing this for a while, can you share with us how you see the work of farm-to-school influencing children today and the significance that that work has on them?
Sure. Farm-to-school is just a piece that is so important, so vital for the students to be connected with their food. We live in an agriculture state, yet so many students still don't have connections with farms. They've never seen a cow be milked. They've never seen a carrot grow. They don't know that potatoes grow underground. And so by connecting the kids with their food, by visiting farms, digging their own potatoes, having a school garden, bringing farmers into the classroom, I've noticed over 7 years the growth of understanding and willingness to try new foods after they've been connected to their food. So at first they're going to say, ew, no, I'm not going to eat a beet. But then we roast beets that they harvested at the farm, and then we cook them over a fire, and they're hungry because they've been working really hard, and they try the beets that they have that wow factor, that holy moly, I'm surprised. I can't believe I actually like these beets. And so then the next time they see it on the cafeteria lunch line, they're going to try it. And then they're going to go home and tell their parents, I want some beets. I like these. And so that whole, just building those relationships with the farmers and the land has grown their palate so much. I just heard from a farmer a couple hours north of here who works with a school that's been doing farm to school for, I think, 6 years. And their young students are now at the high school level. And the kitchen staff said, I can tell that these freshmen have been through the farm-to-school program through elementary school because they are eating more vegetables than we've ever seen kids eat. And so that testimony was like, yeah, this does work.
Wow. Uh-huh.
That's one level. So knowing your farmer, knowing your food, being more likely to eat healthy foods is number one. And then number two, what is kind of, I don't know, maybe a surprising element that keeps coming up is when we're taking kids outside, learning outside in the elements, whether it's snowing or raining, hot, and they're getting dirty, they're connected to the ground, that the students that are usually the troubled kids in class or the quote-unquote bad kids that are kind of bouncing off the walls, they're connected, they're focused. They are so into their experiential learning that the teachers say to me, hey, can we do this every day? This is working. We see them engaged in ways that we never thought this kid could be engaged. So that kind of secondary piece of students learning at different levels has been an amazing piece that I've seen in farm to school working. Mm-hmm. And then I always think, you know, personally, I always focus on the farm-to-school piece, but I've started to say, well, we can't just teach farm-to-school because farm-to-school is everything in nature. They're learning about farm, forest, water, and then it goes into your climate change, sustainability, community-based, and so it leaves for teaching so many other curriculums beyond just farm and food. It's really our whole environment around us, and the students start to realize that they're land stewards, that they have to take care of their land, that they can't throw trash out the window, and that it's their duty to help protect and preserve our environment. And so that kind of third piece has been, it wasn't really my number one focus going into farm to schooling, but it's now becoming the big umbrella over farm to school, is that it's our environment, and that they're becoming more connected with it, which is going to lead to future citizens making healthy choices.
Absolutely. Also, I'm sure you've heard of, and you know, those listening, whether you've heard of, you know, nature deprivation. I mean,
yeah.
Our kids today, you know, maybe in Vermont they're outdoors more than they are here on Long Island, but
nope, surprisingly,
you know,
not
today. You know, the kids today, you know, spend so little time outside in nature compared to, you know, when I was a child. It's remarkable. I mean, they're scheduled from, you know, the minute they get up to when they go to sleep, and the schedule very often is not free play outdoors. The schedule is, you know, soccer, which, you know, is wonderful because it's outdoors a lot of the time, but in the winter, very often it's indoors. And, you know, and you're certainly not exploring nature when you're playing soccer. You're focused on the ball. So, you know, but most of the activities are indoors. They spend so much time in front of these screens. And kids just don't have that same connection with the outdoor world the way they used to. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you see the work you're doing helping that situation?
Yeah. So 7 years into doing farm to school, my first 5 years, I was mostly, you asked about how my time's divided between farm and being in a classroom or taking kids out of the classroom. My first 4 years, I was mostly in the classroom at the schools, trying to, you know, integrating curriculum with cooking and gardening. And now that I'm 7 years into it, I'm working on a project, which I'll talk about in a minute, that is taking fourth grade students out of the classroom onto farms for extended periods of time throughout the seasons. And the goal for that was to connect with the farmer, know your farmer, know where your food's coming from. But as more and more time that I'm spending with the kids, I'm realizing that really what it is connecting them outside, getting them outside, breathing the fresh air, learning how to even be outside. It's amazing how many even Vermont kids and teachers are afraid of insects, afraid of getting dirty or wet, afraid of being cold, and we're trying to take that nature deficit disorder and switch it around and make them realize how much fun it is to be outside and how much you can learn outside. And that focus for me has really been not just farm to school, but I'm now realizing it's also really therapy. We're getting them to kind of break down. You know, when they're outside being cold and wet, they might fall apart for a minute, but then they build back up because they realize they can do it. They can make it through the cold. And they can make some warm tea from herbs that they collected in the garden, and they can warm up. And connecting to nature is changing the way teachers and students and all of us are seeing our day-to-day lives and how we really are inside so much. And I think so many of these students are realizing that they need more time outside. They might not all realize it right away, but I think as time goes through, they know that it is beneficial to be outside because they feel good afterwards. And so taking farm to school outside more is definitely one of my utmost goals going forward.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think it's where it's at, and I see that disconnect with the work I'm doing, and I'm trying to figure out how I can integrate it more. Because right now we also got a grant. That's how the school was able to hire me. But the focus of our program is really, you know, taste testing. You know, kind of like bringing a vegetable in and getting all 3,200 kids to taste it. You know, going to all 6 public schools in the district, and you know, introducing a different vegetable each month, you know, but there's still no connection to the growing of it, no connection to the preparing of it. It's just disconnected, but it's such a big program just to, you know, me alone with 3,200 kids. I'm trying to figure out how to work it better. So I know I still have lots of work to do.
Having videos of farmers at farms, it could be a really fun way to incorporate the taste testing and maybe show a video of where it came from, and maybe the farmer could say a few words about how that food was grown. If you can't get the kids out, it could be a good way to bring that farm into the classroom.
Right, absolutely. But first I have to work into getting the school to make room for that. That's not even a part of it right now.
Yeah.
Right now I'm in the cafeteria when they're eating, you know, all the different lunch periods and just walking around with taste. So it's still kind of disconnected.
Yeah, but Nancy,
I have so many more questions to ask you, but we need to take a couple-minute break first.
Okay.
And then when we come back, we'll talk more about, you know, how you're balancing it all and all the other things, okay?
Sounds great.
Be right back. Everyone, don't go anywhere. We're taking a break.
Search for us to listen and download past shows or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Hey, it's Jesse, PRN station manager. I have an exciting announcement for our amazing listeners. PRN has a new voicemail line that will allow you to connect better with our hosts. If you can't listen live but have a question or comment for one of our hosts, just call 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. This feature will allow your voice to be heard on your favorite PRN show.
Thank you for listening to the Progressive Radio Network.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, this is John Lobel. You can hear my show Visionaries at 10 a.m. on Mondays on PRN. And guess what? PRN now has its own app. So you've always been able to listen to our shows by going to your web browser and putting in PRN.FM. And then you can listen to the current show that's on air. But you can now download onto your smartphone, Android and iPhone, our PRN browser. Search for it in your app store, and you can listen live to whatever's on at the moment. So download now our PRN.FM app.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you are just joining us, my guest today is Missy Doe Axelrod, the farm-to-school educator at the Vermont Farm and Forest School at Driftwood Farmstead. And we're talking about her farm-to-school program. And Missy, right before the break, I wanted to ask you how you're balancing all of these different needs, the outside time, the class time, and the cooking time within the school calendar year?
Good question. So I work with a team. Each of my schools has a farm-to-school team, and we really focus on developing an action plan for each year so that it's not just me going into the school and saying, all right, everybody, I'm here. This is what we're doing. It's really addressing the needs of the school. And we create that action plan, and I try to really work with all the different members of the team to spread out the responsibilities. So we have some schools that are running the taste tests through a class on their own without too much of my involvement. We have usually a different focus each year. This year, we're really looking at this project called School to Farm and working with fourth graders on integrating Vermont history, science, and math at a local farm each month for maybe about 5 hours a day. And that balance is bringing the students outside more. And we kind of just go through the seasons of the year. So in the fall, late August, I spend a lot of time working with teachers, nutrition staff on creating our plan for the year, what the calendar is going to look like. And then at the start of the school year, we're harvesting, we're cooking, we're then putting the beds to bed because the season ends really fast here in Vermont. And then we go into more curriculum integration, pairing with classes and doing in-class work, bringing farmers into the class, doing more taste tests, maybe making cheese or doing felting if it works with their curriculum, and then going into spring, we're starting seeds and then planting, visiting some more farms. And so it really kind of just follows the seasons of the year and spreading that out. I work really closely with the curriculum director at some of the schools and making sure that we're addressing all of the curriculum standards and trying to really develop a pre-K through 12 academic kind of ladder so that we know that at preschool they're learning this, and by the time they get through 12th grade, they'll have met certain learning targets before graduation. And so this has been years and years of working with different team members, and it's always a work in progress balancing, but I feel like we're really making great strides towards integrating it at all grade levels.
And how large are these farm-to-school teams typically at each school?
Usually no more than 10. We usually have one farmer, one community member and or parent. Ideally, we have a principal that's a part of it, and then we have typically 3-4 teachers, somebody that represents elementary school, high school, and then one of the alternative programs, so that it's well-balanced and they're able to relay information back to their school teams.
So you don't have a separate farm-to-school team at the elementary school and then a separate one at the high school? They're kind of together?
No, we don't, because there's only one elementary school to pair with the high school, and the focus at these schools have really been to integrate their action planning together. So we just work together on one team at most of the schools. I have one school district that has several elementary schools, and we do meet separately.
Mm-hmm. And is there a separate wellness policy that you coordinate with as well, or is the wellness policy kind of brought into the farm-to-school team?
A little bit different for each school district, but where it works really well is when there is a strong wellness policy, and then farm-to-school fits in that wellness policy. So it's one of the umbrellas from the wellness policy.
Right. So much to think about. So much great work. And what role does the Vermont Farm and Forest School, along with state organizations and nonprofit organizations, play in creating this foundation for the farm-to-school work that you're doing?
Yeah, so Vermont Feed, Vermont Food Education Every Day, is a collaboration of Shelburne Farms and NOFA Vermont, and it's the organization that really supports statewide programming, as well as the Agency of Agriculture. And then in Vermont, we have smaller organizations that are regional. So we have Food Connects, we have Green Mountain Farm to School, and they're doing the work similar to what I'm doing and working in a variety of schools. And each organization looks a little bit differently. Central Vermont did not have an organization for its region, and so that is kind of what prompted me to create the Vermont Farm and Forest School. And so I'm one of the regional partners that collaborates with Vermont Feed, and we're able to work together, we're able to bounce ideas off of each other, support each other, and then we're each working in our own schools. And that collaboration makes farm-to-school viable. It makes it so that it's state-recognized, statewide. It's not just in one area. And schools typically apply for a grant or the Farm to School Institute, which is a 3-day grant application for coaching. And so they receive a coach, which is typically one of the folks from these regional programs that then support that school for the whole year. And that framework is proving to be really sustainable in Vermont.
So can you explain that a little more? There's a grant for a farm-to-school mentor, basically, to come into the school?
Yeah, we have two grant programs. One is the Vermont Agency of Agriculture Farm-to-School Grant. That is a 2-year grant process where they also get a coach from Shelburne Farms or Vermont Feed or from one of the regional programs, and that coach supports them for 2 years to write an action plan, write a budget, professional development for teachers, nutrition staff, farmers, and that is more in-depth. Kind of the introduction to that is a 3-day workshop conference at Shelburne Farms that is available to all New England farm-to-school programs or schools, and you bring a team to the institute, and you begin your work with farm-to-school. You begin writing an action plan, and then you have that regional coach that follows you for the year and supports you in the work. So that's kind of the introductory level of farm to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to Shelburne Farms once and took an ABCs of farm
oh,
to
good.
School.
Yeah, I did that
yeah.
too.
Yeah, and that was great, but I wasn't yet in the school, so.
Yeah. So if you have a team, the team has to include an administrator, a nurse, and then a teacher, and then the farm to school coordinator, and you can apply for the 3-day farm to school institute, which is also at Shelburne Farms, and it's in-depth learning and creating your action plan. And if you already start with the farm to school, it'll just help you develop an even deeper plan. And it's
right. So it needs to be an administrator, a nurse. Who else has to be there?
A teacher, and then the farm to school coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Farm to School Institute. And that's typically the last week of July every year.
Mm-hmm.
And I highly recommend that for any New England school that is doing farm to school work.
Excellent. Cool. And so at one point you talked about school to farm. Is there a difference between farm to school and school to farm?
Yeah, so this is kind of the next level of farm to school that I'm working on with NOFA, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. We applied for a USDA farm to school grant, which is available every year, and we received the grant. It's a two-year funded project, and our project is School to Farm, Know Your Farmer, Know Your School. And we are focusing on fourth grade because in Vermont, fourth graders typically are doing Vermont history curriculum as part of their humanities. And we figured that is a really great outlet to work on this project because in fourth grade, they're able to take care of themselves a little bit more. They can put on their own snow boots and hats and gloves. And they are at a level where they can be ready to learn more in depth. And so we pair each school that we're working with up with a local farm and a coach to dive deep into farm to school. And so what they're doing is going to the farm once a month for almost a full day, and they're taking their science and their humanities, maybe some math, and they are learning at the farm. So one, they're learning and connecting with their farmer, so they're learning that whole piece of knowing where their food comes from, but then they're also tying it into their standards because that's the one pushback I always hear from schools is that they got to learn their math, they got to learn their science, they need to be in class learning, and so I'm trying to prove that, hey, they can learn all of that outside at a farm, and they're going all year so that they can see changes over time throughout the seasons.
When you say all year, one day a month, all year.
One day a month, yeah.
Right.
And we break into stations so that they're in smaller groups, and we rotate through. So one is a work experience with the farmer, might be washing root vegetables, stacking firewood, harvesting potatoes, and then they're working on their Vermont history curriculum with one of their teachers. And then they'll go to another station where they're doing another activity, diving into their Vermont history curriculum. And then the idea is to take it back to the classroom so that that learning continues at school as well. And the students, have to conduct a taste test for the whole school, highlighting the food from that local farm. And then in the end, they showcase their curriculum learning through a community celebration. So they might prepare some food highlighting their farm partner's harvest and invite community members to be a part of it so that they can see their work. And that is something that we're doing statewide right now, and we will have a kind of a how-to resource book by July that will be available for others to replicate. And it's been a really amazing, eye-opening project, getting these classes outside all day in any kind of weather. They're just learning in different ways, and it's capturing the students who might not learn as well in the four-wall classroom. And the piece of connecting to their farmer is amazing. I'm working with one farm who, within two farm visits with the class, grew five more CSA shares from families and teachers from the school, and she's now offering a free CSA share to the whole class so that they can get a bag of veggies every Friday and cook with it or send it home with different kids. And so that full circle of connecting with the farmer is really proving to really grow with the school to farm project.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just taking farm to school and going even deeper.
Right, right. Sounds great. And then how do you incorporate the cooking in school? Do you do one class at a time, or do you do a cooking demo, or I would assume you want to be doing hands-on with the kids more than a demo.
Yeah, so,
how do you
we
cover
have
a, lot of kids?
A cooking cart. We have a traveling cooking cart, quote-unquote. It's not exactly a cart. We have cutting boards for each kid per class. So we work with one class at a time because more than 20 kids cooking together can get pretty chaotic.
Sure.
So we try to keep it to one class, and we have kid-safe knives, cutting boards, peelers, shredders, cut gloves, so if they're using a shredder, they can't cut their fingers. We have all the equipment that we bring to the classroom, and we prepare the food there. If we're eating in the classroom, I make sure it's something that we can cook on a griddle or eat raw. If it's something that needs to be cooked and we eat it later as part of a school-wide taste test, we're bringing it back to the school kitchen and baking kale chips or cooking the soup on the stove. But we're really making sure that it's hands-on and that the kids are learning about that featured vegetable that we're focusing in on and preparing a recipe from that. And then we send the recipe home with them so that they can try to make it at home as well and share it with their families.
Mm-hmm. So then you must have more than just you going into the different classrooms. You have many different chef mentors, or how do you work that?
I have one staff member that works with me who does a lot of the taste testing and cooking in the classroom, and we just rotate through. So it's just the two of us. I do work with teachers so that they can cook on their own without me, and I'll supply the ingredients and the cooking tools for them, and that happens as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So much information. We're just about out of time, so before we sign off, can you share your contact information or info about your school so people can find you online and find out more information?
DriftFarmsteadVT.com is our website. We're on Facebook, Instagram. My email is VermontFarmAndForestSchool@gmail.com.
Wonderful. And I'll share all that information on my website, too, in case you listeners out there didn't get it. But, Missy, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful. Are you going to the conference this weekend down in Maryland?
I will be there for Monday presenting on School to Farm, Know Your Farmer, Know Your School. And hopefully I'll be able to make it back because we're expecting a nor'easter Monday night.
Oh, God. Well, good luck to you. Thank you so much for joining me today, and everyone out there listening, thank you so much, and have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week.
Thank
Bye
you,
for
Tom.
Now.